And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We begin today's morning show with one of the special guests who will be part of the upcoming CABA Leadership Conference on October 11th, Inspire 2024. After that, we hear from Racine Public Library's Executive Director Nick Dembski on the topic of book banning in the midst of National Banned Books Week. Here's part one of today's program. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're beginning today's program with a conversation with someone who is a special guest of a special event that is coming up on the 11th of October, Inspire 2024, sponsored by CABA, the Kenosha Area Business Alliance. This is a one-day leadership development experience that's taking place at Journey Church on 75th Street on the south side of Kenosha, all morning long into the early afternoon, with a number of notable innovators and strategists from across the country as special guests making presentations. Among them is my morning show guest today, Jeff Schinnebacher, who is an author, a podcaster, a social entrepreneur, and founder of an exciting nonprofit based in Atlanta called Plywood People. Also responsible for a podcast that I enjoyed very much called Love or Work, which he actually did with his wife, Andre, in which they interviewed more than 100 different married couples exploring what it takes to have a successful and happy marriage. More to the point, today we're going to be talking about his book called Yes or No, How Your Everyday Decisions Will Forever Shape Your Life. And this book comes on the heels of another book called More or Less. And this book is a really insightful, illuminating look at how we make the decisions in our lives on a daily basis, often without giving them very much thought at all. And the way in which how we make decisions can really help shape the way in which we can impact the world and be the kind of people making the kind of difference that we most desire. Again, the book Yes or No, How Your Everyday Decisions Will Forever Shape Your Life, published by David C. Cook. Jeff Schinnebacher, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, it's great. It's great to be here, and it was encouraging to hear. Sometimes you forget all these things you've done over time, and it was encouraging to hear you share some of that. Thanks for telling your listeners and having me.
Right, very good. And again, we are excited about your participation in Inspire 2024, which again is going to be happening on the 11th of October. One of the most intriguing questions is also one of the simplest. Explain the name of your nonprofit, Plywood People, and a little more about its mission.
Yeah, I get that question all the time. Plywood is a nonprofit in Atlanta building a community of social impact leaders. And I started it 15 years ago. I was in between work. I had finished up one project and was exploring what I would do next. And I started going to all these different communities around the world. I went to Rwanda and the Dominican Republic. I went to South Atlanta, and I went to Galveston after the hurricane years ago. And all these places I went, I noticed there was people giving their lives to the restorative work in that community. And also I noticed plywood as a short-term fix to a long-term need. You know, people use plywood to patch up windows and to patch up holes, and you just saw it everywhere I went. And I wrote a little essay initially that I called Plywood People, these people that were doing something significant in their communities and using their talents and gifts to make the world better. And that's where the name came from. Hosted a little event, and people came, and they said, what's next? And now we have an organization 15 years ago that does all kinds of training, you know, service to nonprofit leaders and social impact leaders.
Right. And in sort of the statement in which you summarize what Plywood People is all about, you make reference to it as a center for social innovation. Explain exactly what you mean by those two words, social innovation.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's big problems in our communities, right? There's big needs that exist. And oftentimes those needs and those challenges and those problems are very personal to us. We've lived through some story where it impacted us in a very deep and meaningful way. And so there's social needs and we have to think of new ways to address these big problems. And that's where the term social innovation comes from. And so we get to service people that have a passion for different projects. We don't initiate the projects, they do, and we help them, train them, and get them hopefully to a sustainable organization.
You say at one point in your book, most people flee problems. Problems frustrate. Problems stop people in their tracks. So your book is really all about becoming really effective problem solvers. Are you saying that some people, in a sense, are destined to not be problem solvers, that there are some people in this world who have the gifts to be problem solvers? I mean, bigger problem solvers than, you know, how to fix my garage door. But I mean, problems out in the world, out in the community. Are there some of us where that is our calling, our destiny, and others maybe not so much? Or do you see this as potential within everybody if they just kind of understand this about themselves?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I have two answers to that. I think anyone can be a problem solver. I will say, though, that the majority of us have a friend that complains about everything, right? It's like they can see the worst in everything in the world, and they're just talkers, or they're haters about what someone else is doing, right? And they don't have the resilience probably to help actually solve that problem. And then there's people that see problems and they're attracted to it, and they're gonna fix it in some way. I will say this: if there's a social problem that has affected your life, or maybe a close friend to you, maybe you had a family member, a close friend go through cancer or something like that, you're going to be more associated to addressing this issue, to raising money for this issue, to be in support of this issue. So when a problem becomes personal to an individual, they are going to stick with that problem exponentially long because it's part of their story, you know? And I think when people have, so there's problems that people see in the world, it's like, oh, that's a problem, but they don't do anything about it. But when it becomes like part of your life, part of your story, it's hard to let go of it. And I think those are the people that really dig in deep.
You say at one point, solving a problem plants a stake in history that can never be changed. We will be known by the problems we solve. And what's interesting about that turn of phrase is, I think probably in many ways you're talking about we will be known on big canvases, on big stages, but you certainly talk in other places in your book about how it isn't always just about that, about the person who comes up with a cure for polio or that sort of thing, but that even within your own neighborhood, even within your own family, it can mean a tremendous amount when you are the person to whom ordinary people turn to get certain problems solved. And you share certain real life examples that I think are really moving and inspiring.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I spoke a few years ago at a large chicken company, let's call it Chick-fil-A. And I was talking about this idea of problem solving, and I was like, there's a story we all have of someone that addressed a big problem, probably in your team in the last, you know, 3 months. And they all like raised their hands like, oh yeah, I forget the lady's name, but they referred to her as the chicken nugget solution person. And it was like, there was a struggle of distribution of chicken nuggets, and they couldn't figure out how to get more chicken nuggets to local stores, you know? And it was like, yeah, it was her. She's the chicken nugget problem solver, you know? And everyone kind of points back to that. And what's cool about it is like, that was in a team standpoint, you know? It was like, yeah. So then The question is, how can you contribute your abilities to solve another problem within that team, right? Even on a personal note, I mean, my family, my parents are getting older. My dad just recently turned 80. He's having some physical problems. And my wife is a physician's assistant. And everyone in the family knows, like any medical things, we're leaning on her for the best solutions for our family, right? Because we rely on her abilities to solve problems. And she's not going to address them all, but at least be part of it and engage it for the sake of the family. So it could be really personal. It could be a team standpoint. Even on a neighbor standpoint, just this week, neighbor was yelling over the fence to me, trying to name it, and they're like, I need this specific screwdriver. And they like hold their phone above the fence and they're like, there's a picture of it. And they're like, you got one of these, you know? And I was like, actually, I think I do. And there's some set I have. So I go into my house and I get the screwdriver, and all of a sudden now the relationship with my neighbor, it's not just cordial. It's like we're helping each other. And I think there's something really valuable about that. I'm not just thinking about myself. We're thinking communally about how we can address these things together.
We're speaking with Jeff Schinnebarger, author of Yes or No, How Your Everyday Decisions Will Forever Shape Your Life. He is one of the nationally known guests that will be part of Inspire 2024, a one-day leadership development conference coming up on the 11th of October. You talk, of course, a great deal about the choices that we make. And there's a really interesting exercise you suggest that we undertake. Your book, by the way, is full of them, tangible exercises and kind of understanding some of the concepts you talk about. But when it comes to choices we make on a daily basis, you suggest an exercise in which we try to chronicle or catalog every single choice we make through the course of a day. And you just list the plethora of choices we make before we sit down for breakfast. Choice after choice after choice after choice. And of course, part of that is to come to a better understanding of the nature of the choices we make in life and maybe the way in which we tend to make choices. Briefly, I'm afraid, what would be some of your best advice in terms of us being better at making the choices we make in our daily lives and the big choices as well that have to do with making an impact on the world?
Well, it's interesting. First of all, if you go through that exercise where you're like, oh, these are all the choices I made, it could be exhausting. It can wear you out, to be honest. But one of the things I've been thinking about recently is just how when you make one choice, how all of a sudden a series of next choices emerge. And sometimes we get really paralyzed by massive life change moments. And what we need to do is make the next right decision. So I can't solve everything at this moment, but I know, example, you might be in a job and it's not really lining up perfectly with your abilities. And it's like, so what is the next choice? Is it to quit your job, or is it just to like make a resume? You know what I mean? Like, that's not life changing, making a resume. It's the next right thing to do. And then when you get that resume, then the question becomes, what do I do with that resume? Do I put that on a job posting thing? Do I send it to someone? Do I get feedback on it? And so I've been encouraging people, and I've been thinking about this from my own life also, is like, what's the next right thing to do? I don't have to change everything in life, but I have to make a decision to step forward in some way.
One of the things that may surprise people if they take up your book is that you spend a fair amount of time talking about love. And you also differentiate love from other feelings that we might have in our mind and heart that might at a glance seem to be the same as love, but love is the term to which you really gravitate quite a lot, and particularly when it comes to the way in which we go about the world and the way in which we think about confronting some of the problems that we see in the world around us. Tell us a little more about love and why love figures so prominently in some of these calculations in terms of being a more effective presence in the world?
Well, I think on a baseline, I love my wife. Her name is Andre, and that love has changed my life. And a lot of people are searching for that kind of love in their life. I think that there's I've found, even since I wrote that book, I found there's three types of love that have really impacted me. And they're the three very hard things to find. The first is finding a person you love that you want to spend life with, right? The second is finding the love of your work. So what do I have to contribute to the world? And that's a hard thing to find passion and love and strengths that you can give to others. And then the third, which is really funny, it's even harder, is to fall in love with your partner's purpose, which is do I value her strengths and abilities and purpose in life as equal to my own? Most of the time, her and I would both say we don't, but we've learned that we actually do, because when the person that we love is doing the thing that they love, it actually brings you joy. You get so excited about it. So, I think these things drive us. It fuels joy. It fuels life. It keeps us going. It contrasts the issues of mental health, and it gives us a reason to wake up every day. And those are drivers for me.
Of course, one of the realities that you talk about is love in the broad perspective seems beautiful and simple, but in the details, love ultimately has competition. How do we choose what we love most, and how do we respond to that tension in community? And shortly thereafter, your suggestion is consider prioritizing your loves. How do you suggest that people do that, and to what benefit does that lead?
Yeah, there's a lot of things I like. I like watching college basketball. I have a lot of hobbies. Those are things that we like, but the loves give us a longer term engagement for sure. It's not going to just fizzle out. It's personal. I think there's always a destiny people have of trying to find this love, but there are loves along the way. So I think it starts by writing things out. You had a great experience at something. I really loved that. I loved being a part of that. What did you love about that? Was it the experience, or was it the interaction with the people, or was it a specific person in that group? I mean, there's a lot of, it's hard. It's hard to find it, but it's a desire that I think so many people have. But it probably starts with on a more consistent basis, identifying things that bring you joy. And some of that might be things you like, and some of those might be things you really like.
We're speaking with Jeff Shinnebarger, and we're talking about his book, Yes or No, How Your Everyday Decisions Will Forever Shape Your Life. The book is really about, more than anything, how one can be a tremendously effective problem solver in terms of confronting issues that one might see in your community, even your nation, even the world, or maybe simply in your own life. And what it means to be a truly effective problem solver, and in particular, some of the ways in which the way we make our choices and decisions can play a very, very significant role in whether or not we are effective and successful. One of my favorite parts of the book is where the heading is "Be a Problem Solver." And you, at this point, quote Albert Einstein, who said, "The significant problems we face cannot be solved at the same level of thinking we were at when we created them." So talking about a need, at the outset, you go on to say, "We all have dreams of becoming known for something significant. Problems are solved by having a dream and making decisions every day to pursue that dream." And then you go on to say, "I have found that there are four common practices that problem solvers choose. And I really appreciated this. Although a couple of them, in a sense, are relatively obvious, I think they are very, very well worth exploring and discussing them in the way you do, including the first one, be in places where problems happen. I mean, how obvious and yet how important and how often we forget that basic fact.
Yeah, I mean, to be really honest, as you gain influence and gain wealth, you are positioned in places where everything becomes more and more perfect, right? You get invited to the VIP reception. You are in a special lounge. You're at a country club. Like, I'm thinking about the most wealthy and the most famous. Like, the more influence you have, the more money you have, you separate yourself from the problems of the world, which is so sad. I mean, because actually in the midst of problems, that's where you find new ideas. That's where you grow. That's where you innovate. That's where all these things happen. You know, like, the greatest inventions of our times happen in hard economic seasons because somebody had a new idea to address an old problem. And so, yeah, I think it's interesting. I have a friend, his name's Leroy. I've traveled with him at different times, and we go into a new city, and he's like, getting a taxi or an Uber or whatever you use, he'll say, take me to the neighborhood where there's the greatest challenges. And he just likes to drive through because what's interesting is you see beauty in a way that you don't see it in other places. You'll see this mural of an amazing artist in the midst of a neighborhood that's really going through some challenges and needing some different things addressed in it. And there'll be a mural that just speaks incredible hope and life, and it stands out in the midst of everything else, you know? So, yeah, I think it's funny, though. Most of us retreat and try to run from problems. But in the midst of problems, that's where new ideas come from, and that's where new life begins.
And that's so exciting. As, of course, is the whole matter of making choices to confront problems. And I love the way in which you tie this back to real life. You tell a really amusing story about a problem that you and your wife had to confront when one day something showed up on your driveway that was not quite expected, and the two of you had to figure out what in the world to do. And it leads to the whole matter of expanding one's options, which is a great way to think about how to confront a problem. Tell our listeners about this story to which I'm referring.
Oh, my goodness. You're bringing back, like, triggers from my life here right now, all these old stories. My wife, I think this is the story that I'm like, she had this idea of getting mulch for our yard, and she had heard that sometimes you can call tree companies that are cutting down trees, and they'll, if you want mulch, they'll just drop it off, whatever they cut that day, in your driveway. Well, she didn't tell me she had called this place. And I pulled in, and there's a pile of mulch, and I'm not exaggerating 1 ounce. The mulch pile was higher than our house. It was above the roof line, like where our gutters are. It was massive. It was just this massive, and it's like, we could do this over our entire yard and we'd still have extra. So we used as much as we could. And then finally it was just like, okay, what are we going to do with all this mulch? So we started bagging it, and every single friend that would come over, I would conveniently just have a bag ready and put it in the back of their car. So yeah, I mean, sometimes things happen and you got to respond and get creative.
Well, and that whole matter then of what are the possibilities here? Is a really interesting exercise that you suggest we think a lot about. I mean, that often our first response is, well, we can do this or this, and in fact, in many instances, we can expand the list of possibilities, and all kinds of interesting things become possible. I did want to mention that one thing that is quite present in your book is your own religious faith. And one of the things I appreciate about that is that you're very straightforward in talking about the way in which that has had an impact on who you are and how you move through the world. And yet you certainly acknowledge the fact that not everybody who picks up this book, nor everybody who attends this event coming up on October 11th, is going to share that same faith experience with you. I just wonder if you could just say a quick word about how you folded that into this book. And in general, as you speak to crowds that certainly have all kinds of people who view the world and life a bit differently than you do, how you like to make that a part of what you have to say.
Yeah. Honestly, I think people that see the world different than me have caused me to become a better person in my life. So I think there's a framework we all have that we grew up in, stories that we learn based on our parents and our families and the circumstances we have to start to shape this worldview that we see the world. And that's part of mine. My dad was a pastor and I grew up in that faith system. And over time, I've gotten to experience so many different people in the world that have shaped how I see it and see it differently. A great example of this is we have a co-working space in Atlanta and that we started, and there's about 150 people that call this place their office. And in this place, there's different faith systems, there's different ethnicities, there's different ages, there's different orientation. There's all different types of people that call this place their office. And that's one of my favorite things about what I get to do is I walk into a place where there's people that see the world different than me, and I get to be educated every day. I think those are the people that have shaped who I am and who I'm becoming, not just where I've been in the past. And so I bring that into everything. I hope people would say that I'm a person that values other cultures, that values other ways of seeing the world. On a personal level, my wife and I, we try to take our kids out of the country every year. And this past year, we went to Japan. And it made us see the world so different. And I feel like I'm such a greater human because of that. So I try to wrap it into everything.
That's very, very well put. I applaud that very, very much. And there are so many things that I appreciated about your book and what it has to say. One of my favorite lines is this: much of the joy of life can be found when we realize what a great privilege it is to live intentionally, making choices, remembering all that God has given. The book again is Yes or No: How Your Everyday Decisions Will Forever Shape Your Life. The book is published by David C. Cook, and the author, Jeff Schinnebarger, will be one of the nationally known guests who will be presenting at CABA's event on October 11th, 2024, Inspire 2024 at Journey Church on the south side of Kenosha. Jeff Schinnebarger, thank you so much for writing this intriguing book and for being my morning show guest. It was great to speak with you. Best wishes.
Thank you. It's so good to hear from you, and I can't wait to be with everyone in Kenosha in just a few weeks.
And for more information about Inspire 2024 or to register for the event, go to the website of the Kenosha Area Business Alliance, which is kaba.org. That's K-A-B-A, kaba.org. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This week is National Banned Books Week. And to finish out today's program, we're going to be hearing from the executive director of the Racine Public Library, Nick Dembski, who wants to remind all of us that book banning and censorship has been with us for a very, very long time.
We could start just by having the broader perspective of this is not a new practice, right?
Mm.
Book banning, censorship, and anti-censorship activism has been as old as, it predates the written word, right?
Mm.
It's as old as human history. And because of that, we can look in history and see places throughout the world, right? Because this is a global phenomenon, and times throughout all of human history of when this activity really spiked. And what we know is that we don't look very kindly upon those places and times when those things spiked. I know that last time I was on your show, you and I were talking about we were connected through Carthage College. And when I was at Carthage in 2005, I had the opportunity to visit Germany and Poland to study the Holocaust. And this is, you know, one of the pinnacle global examples in more recent human history, anyways, of where intellectual freedom was threatened on a very, very wide scale level by a nation. And we have, you know, that example, of course, includes not just book challenges and book bans, but book burning, which really becomes symbolic for so much of this. So to get to your question, anyways, of, you know, what does it look like in my lifetime? That's a really great sort of, in my opinion, just like mile marker, because what I can say is, you know, we've seen an increase, like dramatic exponential increases in this activity throughout this country, basically from right around the pandemic time. So 2020 and especially 2021 and every year since then, you know, we have preliminary data for 2024, but full data for 2023 and every year prior. Every year since then, we've seen exponential book bans throughout the country. And what I always say about that, my reflection on that, is we've just never seen anything like that in my lifetime, right? I've been in the field of librarianship for 17 years, and certainly we haven't seen it in that time. But even prior to that, in all the 41 years I've been alive, this is just not a challenge that libraries throughout the country have experienced in the same way.
One of the things I'm curious about in terms of the sorts of books that are being banned is, I think what we tend to read the most about are, you know, a book about, like a children's book, and this child has two dads. I mean, something like that up the possibility of that you don't have to have a mom and a dad and kids to be a loving family. In certain places where that notion seems radical, we could imagine a book like that being banned. And it, generally speaking, is that what we are seeing, those kind of books being banned that we might think of as quite open-minded? Or are some of the books being banned maybe on the other end of the spectrum, offering up, you know, maybe bigoted or hateful sorts of ideas and being banned for what we might think of as very different reasons? I mean, are we seeing book banning kind of across the political spectrum, or is it really on one end of the spectrum that we are seeing this huge rise?
That's another really excellent question, yeah, and one that I think a lot of people just sort of skip past or make assumptions about. What I can say to that initially is I think, you know, what is very demonstrated in the data, you know, before in my life, again, or even in our community in Racine, when you saw a book ban or a book challenge, it was usually a good faith effort by a family or a parent or something like that, just saying like, hey, this book really makes me uncomfortable. You know, my child took this out and I didn't like the material and I didn't want them reading it. And, you know, lodging a complaint or maybe filling out a sort of formal form, if that's what the library's policy has, to say, you know, I want to challenge that this be here or not. And there's processes that librarians, you know, like professional standard operating procedures that librarians will go through to check, like, okay, is that the case or not? And sometimes it would be in some way or another. Say just like a sex education book that's maybe just in the juvenile section or maybe in the teen section. Maybe the content is reviewed and they realize, you know, this should be in the young adult section, or this should be, you know, from the juvenile section to the teen section, something like that. So again, these are good faith efforts that are being responded to in good faith ways by people professionally trained to do this. Now what we're seeing is sort of these large scale. It's not, you know, maybe it's in coordination with a family or an individual who is a member of the community, but it's really a coordinated national effort. And when we see books being challenged, it's like dozens at a time, right? In 2023, I think, let's see if I remember this information, but there were, I believe, 17 different states that saw over 100 book challenges. It might even be book bans. But Wisconsin was one of those 17 states.
Wow.
So, you know, to get back to your question, though, that's related, I think, to what you're saying. You're basically asking two questions. One, is this sort of related to political positioning? And it is, right? This activity is. Book banning is not exclusive to one, you know, political orientation or another. And people on the left, the way they, I would say, challenge what we'll just call information material, you know, like books, for instance, is usually more at the publisher level or the bookseller level, something that is kind of a longstanding tradition in different kinds of civil rights activities. But basically by saying, you know, not necessarily saying we don't want this book to exist, but publishing a challenge or a publisher, challenging a publisher rather. So if Penguin is getting ready to publish a book that certain groups would consider hate speech, they will challenge that publisher in some kind of ways and make a pressure campaign against them. And if they're successful, then Penguin may drop that book or that author. That book will probably still get published, but it'll be by a publisher that more overtly holds the same values that book is representing. These challenges that we're seeing in libraries, whether it's school libraries or public libraries, those tend to be more, you know, focused from political conservatism. Though certainly not all, right? I want to make that very clear. Like, not all conservatives are for book bans or challenges. And the data that we have is actually the majority of conservatives, the majority of Americans in general, are very opposed to book bans and challenges. But then the second part of your question was, are we seeing these in relation to basically, you know, LGBTQ plus book contents and, you know, contents that have to do with communities of color? And yes, a lot of books written by authors of color or featuring the stories of characters of color, you know, they made up, I think, like 40%, 47% of targeted censorship attempts between BIPOC, you know, stories and the LGBTQ plus stories. 47%, that was in 2023. So we know that this is definitely related to that. And, you know, the last thing that I'll say about that is, you know, some of these are just history books, right? Some of these are just talking about factual events that happened in American history or other history. And when you have groups that feel threatened by that to the point that they're trying to suppress that information or get that information, you know, it's one thing if a family says, I don't want my child reading about this for whatever reason. Families get to make decisions for their children about the content that they take in all sorts of ways. But when a family or an individual is saying, I don't want my entire community to have access to this information.
Right. I don't want any children to read this book.
Yeah. That's a dangerous prospect,
right,
as we've seen in history.
So what typically happens when an entity like the Racine Public Library receives some kind of complaint or concern is raised? Typically, how are such concerns received?
Sure. Yeah, so I guess I would start by that by saying, again, it's a little different than it's ever been in my life, because part of these coordinated national efforts from groups, like you suggested, that maybe have political agendas, right? That it's not just about a good faith effort to challenge a certain book because of an experience they had with it in their community, but they're doing these widespread book challenges. Part of that effort also has included kind of, in certain communities, trying to basically take over the authoritative body of certain libraries or other institutions. And so, like at the Racine Public Library, that would be our library board, right? So there are some communities where when, these challenges are coming from people who have newly taken on authoritative roles in the library, that's a very different kind of situation. It's one that, again, we just haven't seen in my lifetime, really. And so that would have to be dealt with kind of particularly to that community in that scenario, right? But more broadly to your question, when a book challenge is brought up at a library, usually, hopefully, the library is responsible in having a policy, maybe even a form for the person to fill out for that particular book or that particular item. If it's not a book, maybe it's a DVD, whatever the case might be. That usually would trigger something like a committee being formed if a challenge is submitted. That committee would be made up of people, at the Racine Public Library anyways, people with master's degrees in this topic, people with backgrounds, people who are professionals in the information economy. A lot of the tactics that librarians would then use to consider, okay, is this person correct or not? One, of course, they review the material themselves a little bit, which now we're seeing a lot of book challenges where that hasn't actually been done. The people and organizations are submitting challenges without actually having read the material themselves.
Mm.
So one, the librarians would do that, but two, they would go to the professional literature, the places where reviews are being done for this, and especially if it's something around age, at every review site, an appropriate age range is identified for the material that they're talking about. And if every single review site agrees on what that appropriate age range is, then that's a significant piece of information for evaluating that challenge.
Interesting. Any further thoughts that you have for any of our listeners, particularly in terms of the way all of us should be thinking about the whole matter of the banning of books?
Well, I think maybe the final thought that I'll leave you with again is, this is not new, right? This is a very old practice, and it's something that has come up in this country many times. I think the last time we've seen efforts to this degree in this country was in the 50s. But because of that, I would also say these questions around censorship and book banning have been asked and answered by America before. And every time when we've, I mean, it's interesting to see it playing out now, right? Like, you have examples with Governor DeSantis in Florida where, you know, he was kind of positioning himself to be a huge champion of book challenges and bans. But what he found is there were people on the political right that were willing to take this to such a degree that he suddenly became kind of the person advocating wait a minute, we need to hit the brakes here. This isn't making any sense. This is stepping outside of the bounds of reason. And that is, you know, what intellectual freedom advocates would always talk about, is the slippery slope. And that just is the reality of it. When you start doing this, you start walking into very dangerous territory. And so that is why a public library like Racine Public Library, if someone comes in asking for, you know, information that is very on the right or information that is very on the left, we provide it gladly, one way or the other. It's not a judgment call for us. It's about access to that information for our community members. And that is really, I think, where we all should be focused. And that really should be kind of the period at the end of the sentence. These are questions that have been asked and answered. And so it would be great if we would just look at the history of that rather than have to relive the history of that.
Mm. Very well put. Nick Dembski, Executive Director of the Racine Public Library, I think you've offered some really thoughtful and valuable perspective on this in the midst of National Banned Books Week. Thank you so much for your time. Very best wishes to you and everyone at the Racine Public Library.
Thank you, Greg. Have a great Banned Books Week.